delighted that you're here tonight. I appreciate the presence of everyone. We've appreciated the presence every night. We've had good numbers. As we come to the midweek of, not actually the middle of the week, but midweek as far as the number of weekdays that we have in this gospel meeting, I want to again express my appreciation to the elders for the invitation to come and to be with you, to be the speaker in this meeting. And I hope that the time is passing swiftly and profitably for you, and that something is being said or done that will help you in your journey toward heaven. I appreciate the way that you've listened and the kind comments that you've made. I'm encouraged by all these young children that sit up here toward the front and some scattered throughout the auditorium as they listen well. They're taking notes and the comments that they make. It is unusual for young children sometimes to come out and comment on a sermon. They're more interested in other things, but a number of these have, and I appreciate so much the encouragement that they have been to me as well. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, the subject of stewardship is introduced for us, where Paul said, "Let a man so consider us as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required in stewards that one be found faithful." Paul described himself and other apostles as being stewards, he said. The word steward means simply a manager of a household or estate. It's a compound word which means to arrange a house or to manage the household affairs. One who is a steward is one who manages something that belongs to another. The Bible describes us as being stewards. We are stewards of our money. Actually, it is not our money, and that's why we are stewards. All things belong to God. And so the money that God has allowed us to use, we are stewards of that. We are stewards of our time. We're to be stewards of our children. While they are our children, they are also a gift from God, and so we are stewards of those children. We're stewards of God's Word, as per 1 Corinthians 4, verses 1 and 2, as we just read a few moments ago. We are stewards of our material possessions. Everything that you have, be it your money, be it your possessions of your house, your cars, the clothes that you have, we are to be stewards of the possessions that God has granted unto us. But it's also true that we are to be stewards of our tongues, that we are to manage them properly and use them as God would have us to use them. And that's the focal point of our study tonight. Let's talk about being stewards of the tongue. That God expects us to be stewards of our tongue, to manage them and handle them properly for His service and for His cause. Let's start by looking at Psalm 39 and verse 1, where I see that being a child of God should affect the fact of how we use our tongue and how we talk. That's not always true that some people become Christians, or they become what they call a Christian, and they are not affected at all by the way that they talk. Their speech does not change. Their tongue does not change. They still abuse the tongue and misuse the tongue. Here's what the psalmist said. He said, "I will guard my ways lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle while the wicked are before me." Notice particularly the first phrase, that I will guard my ways lest I sin with my tongue. That I'm going to be careful lest I commit a sin with the tongue. I want to suggest to you that there are many ways in which we may misuse our tongue and that we may abuse our tongues. We may abuse our tongues by lying. We may abuse them by cursing, by taking casual oaths and swearing, by angry words, by gossip, by flattery, by grumbling and complaining. There are those and many other ways, perhaps, that we could abuse our tongues. But I'm not going to notice all of those tonight. I want our focal point to be on how we misuse our tongues in dealing with one another, particularly as brethren. But it would also be true as we deal with our neighbors or as business people, as we deal with customers, or maybe as we deal with people who are in the business world or our neighbors, our friends, and even our families. Let's talk about how we abuse our tongues as we deal with one another. 4 points we want to establish in our study tonight. The first thing we want to consider is that the tongue is a danger. And if we understand something to be a danger, that ought to cause us to be very careful with that. If you've never used some tool before, and someone could convince you this tool is very, very dangerous, it ought to cause you to be a little careful with your use of that. The same is true with anything. any item, any product that you buy, if it's very dangerous to use and there is great potential for harm to come, we'll be very careful with that. And the same thing should be true with reference to our tongue. Let's talk about some principles that tell us it's a danger. We start with James 3 and verse 8, and we learn from this passage that the tongue is never fully tamed. The tongue is never fully tamed. James chapter 3 says as much as any single chapter of the Bible about the tongue and the abuses of the tongue and the misuse of the tongue. And James 3 and verse 8 said, the tongue can no man tame. Or as the New King James says, no man can tame the tongue. That doesn't mean a man can't control his tongue. It doesn't mean that it's out of control, so therefore whatever you say is just out of your control, because after all, nobody can control their tongue anyway. That's not the point. The point is it can never be fully trusted. In the context of James chapter 1 and also James chapter 3, the comparison is made of taking the tongue and bridling the tongue like you would bridle a horse. And notice what we learn from Psalm 32 and in verse 9. Turn back to the Psalms, if you will. In Psalm 32 and verse 9, it talks about a horse that may be broke, a horse that yet, even though he's broke, cannot be fully trusted, because he said, do not be like the horse or like the mule, which have no understanding, which must be harnessed with bit and bridle. You understand how a horse has to have a bit and a bridle, because you can't fully trust him. You have horses that are wild and never been broken. Then you have horses that are green broke, that you can trust them a little bit, but you can't trust them a whole lot. But even a dead broke horse, you can't just jump on his back with a saddle without a bit and bridle, because you can't fully trust him. You can never turn your back on him. You have to keep your eyes glued to what he's doing. You have to be attuned to the movements of the horse, because you can't fully trust him. And here's the point of this passage in James chapter 3 and in verse 8. The point is you can't fully trust the tongue. It's like you've got to keep the reins tight. Just like you do with a horse you can't fully trust. You think he's broke, you think he's going to behave, but you better hold tight, because you don't know what he's about to do. And so you hold on to your tongue, and you pull the bridle back a little bit, and you pull the reins back on your tongue. You keep a close grip on the tongue, because you're not so sure what it's about to do. And what I learned from that is that even the most mature Christian has to work at it. I don't care if you've been a Christian for 50 years or 60 years, or perhaps even longer, you have not yet reached the point that you can say, you know what, I can take the bridle off my tongue and I can let it do whatever it wants to, because it will never get me in trouble. You better watch out. That's like taking the bridle off the horse and say, he's dead broke, we've trusted him for years, and he will never hurt anybody. So we're not even going to put a bridle on him. You better watch out, you're liable to get hurt. And that's the point of James chapter 3 and verse 8. Even the most mature Christian has to keep working at controlling the tongue. Here's a second principle that tells me it's a danger. And that is that I must give an account for every idle word that I shall speak. Jesus said this in Matthew 12 and verse 36 and 7, that every idle word that man shall speak, he shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. How would it be if you were called into the courtroom and you had to give an account for half of what you had said in life? That's all you have to give an account for. Not all of you said, but just half of what you said. Wouldn't that be kind of scary? They call you in before the court and they have a record. There's recordings of everything you've ever said, but you only have to answer for half of what you said. I would tremble in my boots at that. And yet before the judge of all the earth, I'll stand one day to give an account for every idle word that I shall speak. That causes me to tremble in my boots as well. That tells me the tongue is a danger. I better be careful with that. Here's another thing that tells me it's a danger, and that is that I could easily be guilty of what I say is true of others. That's true of the tongue, more so perhaps than any other thing that we could be charging others guilty of. While I may be pointing my finger at someone and accusing them of gossip, I very well could be guilty of gossip myself. And while I condemn someone for slander, I could be guilty of slander myself. And while I accuse people of being guilty of backbiting, it might be I'm doing the very same thing. And while I shake my finger at some brother for being so harsh with his tongue, it very well may be that I'm being harsh with my tongue as well. I could easily be guilty of what I say is true of others. The tongue can get me in trouble, is what I'm learning. Here's another principle that tells me the danger of the tongue, and that is I can sin with the tongue. It's not just it may get me in a little trouble. We've all said things that embarrassed us. We've all let words out that if we could draw them back and catch them before people heard, then we'd have done that. We've had slips of the tongue, and we wished we hadn't have said that. Maybe we said a word that we didn't mean to say, and we're embarrassed by that. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about, it's possible I could say things that are sinful in their nature because I've used my tongue in a sinful manner. That's possible. We'll not notice every detail of these three passages, but you'll notice as I cite Romans 1, Galatians 5, 2 Corinthians 12, you'll recall from your study of the text that all of those are passages that we call catalogs of sin, where the apostles writing would talk about a number of sins, and he puts a whole group of them together. So let's go to Romans chapter 1 to start with. This is a passage that lists the catalog of sins of the Gentiles. The whole point of the first chapter of Romans is to show the Gentiles are in sin and they need salvation. Why? Because they have sinned. They've turned against God. What did they do that was so wrong? Listing their sins, notice in verse 29, they're filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, envy, murder. And then notice he also adds whisperers in verse 29. That they're backbiters, verse 30, and haters of God. They're proud and they're boasters. Some of the things that he just mentioned are things they did with their tongue. They sinned with their tongue. Let's notice Galatians chapter 5 and verse 20. And the same point could be made from 2 Corinthians 12. We'll not look at it, but Galatians 5 and verse 20, you'll recall that passage dealing with the works of the flesh. And notice in verse 20, he had said in verse 21 that those who do such things should not inherit the kingdom of God. These sins will cause you to lose your soul. Among those things that he mentions not only idolatry and sorcery, hatred, contentions. He mentions jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, and heresies. You recognize some of those as being sins of the tongue. And that tells me my tongue is a danger. I could be guilty of the things that cause me to lose my soul with reference to the tongue. So now I know the tongue is a danger. It's a dangerous thing. I'd better be very careful. But let's talk about what it can do. Much like someone is using a saw for the first time and someone says, that's dangerous. Well, tell me what it can do. Well, it cuts your finger off. That's what it can do. So let's understand the danger that's involved. I know it's dangerous, but let's talk about what the tongue is capable of doing. Here's the first thing we want to notice, starting with Matthew, the 18th chapter, verses 15 through 17. You see, it's possible for me to sin against my brother. Usually, not always, but usually that sin will be accomplished by the tongue. When we think of this passage and make application of this passage, it's usually in the context of where someone has said something about another. Not always, but that's usually how that sin is committed. Notice in verse 15, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you've gained your brother. Well, that's enough for us to establish the fact that it's possible for one to sin against his brother. So here's what my tongue could do. I could use my tongue so as to sin against my brother. So that I have done wrong, my soul is in danger because I have abused and misused my tongue. But let's turn to James chapter 4 and notice another sin. It's possible, here's what the tongue is capable of doing. James chapter 4 verse 11, I could be guilty of slander. Notice in James 4 and verse 11, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. Who speaks evil of his brother speaks evil of the law and is a judge of the law. Be not a judge of the law, for you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. How are you becoming a judge of the law? Because the law says not to judge and condemn your brother and slander your brother, and when you do, you've judged the law, saying that doesn't apply to me. That law's not important. I don't have to follow that law. And that's how we become judges of the law. But notice he's condemning slander. Let's go to Proverbs 10 and in verse 18. And as you're turning there, notice before you, as you're turning to Proverbs, notice before you the definition from vines of slander. What are we talking about when we're talking about slander? Slander has to do, according to vines, of accusing falsely, given to finding fault with the demeanor and conduct of others and spreading their innuendos and criticisms in the church. You ever known of that to happen? Ever known someone that doesn't go to some brother when they sin and try to correct that privately, But one who is perusing through the lives of others and they're trying to find fault by what they do, find fault in their conduct, find fault in their attitude, find fault in their words, they're looking for some fault, and if they haven't found it, they go searching for it. And once they find something they don't like, they spread their innuendos and criticism throughout the church. You ever seen that? Sure you have. Notice what Proverbs 10 and verse 18 says. Whoever hides hatred has lying lips. The King James says that he hides hatred with his lying lip, and whoever spreads slander is a fool. Spread slander in what sense? He's spreading slander in that he's given to finding fault in the demeanor and the conduct of others, and he spreads that throughout the church. We could be guilty of that. That's the thing the tongue could be guilty of and could do. But here's something else. I could be guilty of gossip and being a busybody. Paul would write in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 13 of the danger of young widows that they ought to marry and bear children because if they are given to idle time, he said, they could become gossips and busybodies, wandering about from house to house, speaking things which they ought not. They become gossips and busybodies. What does it mean to be a busybody? Vine says it means to working round about, to be working round about, instead of at one's own business, to be meddling with or bustling about other people's matters. Some who are not busied in their own business, but are over-busied in that of others. Have you ever known someone who couldn't take care of their own affairs for meddling in everybody else's affairs? They've got their nose in everybody else's business. They want to know what's going on and about their money and about their lives and about their decisions that they make. And they talk to everybody and his brother about it. What could I be doing with my tongue that's so bad? I could be guilty of gossip. And I could be a busybody. One of the best definitions of gossip I've ever heard was that someone said that gossip is saying something you like about someone you don't. Pretty good definition. When you start saying things you like to say about someone you don't like, then we might think about the sin of gossip. Here's something else. I could be guilty of the sin of backbiting. Several passages mention this, but let's start with Romans chapter 1. And in verse 30, we talked about the sins of the Gentiles. When he catalogs the number of sins found in the context, notice verse 30 says they're backbiters and haters of God. It's interesting to me that being a backbiter is put in the same context of being one who is sexually immoral, one who is covetous, one who is guilty of murder and strife, and a hater of God and proud. He puts the backbiter right in the same context and in the same category. Let's go back to the book of Proverbs. If you don't already have an Old Testament, perhaps there's one in the pew. We're going to look at a number of Old Testament passages this evening. Notice in Proverbs 25 and verse 23. Proverbs 25 and verse 23, he says, that the north wind brings forth rain and a backbiting tongue and angry countenance. The passage talks about the danger of a backbiting tongue, one who is gossiping behind someone else's back, and destroying the character and the reputation of another. Now, I know the tongue is a danger, first of all. It can be very, very dangerous. I need to be careful. Secondly, I know what it can do. I can sin with my tongue. I can sin against my brother. I can be guilty of slander and of gossip and backbiting. Let's now talk about the effect that it can have. What kind of effect can it have? Let's go back to the book of Proverbs now and get your Bible and turn to Proverbs 11 and verse 9. And let's notice the effect that it can have. Now, I know what I can do. I know it's dangerous. What kind of impact can it have? We're going to notice a number of things in Proverbs. Start with Proverbs 11 and in verse 9. Proverbs 11 and verse 9 says, I could destroy my neighbor. Notice he said, the hypocrite with his mouth destroys his neighbor. Can you destroy your neighbor? You can destroy his name and his character and his reputation with what you say. It might be true what you say or it may be false. But you can destroy someone's name and their character and their reputation. You can destroy them so that they're gone. Oh yes, they're still living. But as far as they're standing in the church and they're standing in the community, you've destroyed that. How? By your tongue. What can we do with the tongue? We could reveal secrets. Notice in Proverbs 11 and verse 13, while you're still open there, that a talebearer reveals secrets, but he is of a faithful spirit, conceals the matter. It's possible I could misuse my tongue and I could tell things where someone has confided in me. All of us know things that we know ought not be told. All of us have had people confide in us and tell us something that we ought not share with anyone else. Maybe someone has come to talk to us about their problem. Maybe it's some intimate problem they've got, and we begin to tell that, and we're revealing secrets that ought not to be told. I can reveal secrets and betray trust that ought not to be betrayed. Well, let's go to another passage. Let's go to the 16th chapter, if you will, and notice in verse 28, Proverbs 16, and in verse 28, it's possible I could sow strife. He said, a perverse man sows strife. It's possible that I could say things and say them in such a way, and I could agitate things, maybe like looking for a fault and spreading their innuendos through the church. That's what slander is. But by doing so, I stir up strife within a local church. I could sow strife within a family so that a family is just torn apart. How could I do that? I could do that by my tongue, by the things that I say. Furthermore, same passage now. Chapter 16, verse 28, I could separate the best of friends. Notice he said that a whisperer separates the best of friends. Jump to the next chapter, 17, verse 9, that he who repeats a matter separates the best of friends. That might be that by my tongue, I'm separated now from one of my best friends. Friendship have been destroyed because of the tongue, because of something that was said. Or it might be that I'm not the one that's the friend. It may be two other people that are friends. And what I said about one of them or both of them has caused friction between the two of them. I've destroyed a relationship by my tongue. Look how powerful it is. Here's something else. Go to Galatians 5 and verse 15, this time to the New Testament. Then we'll make our way on over to the book of James. It's possible that with the use of the tongue, a church could be destroyed. Notice in Galatians 5:15, he said, but if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. Like a pack of dogs who are biting and snarling and snapping, and they're biting and devouring one another until finally one of them is dead or all of them are dead. So likewise, if you bite and devour one another, take heed lest you be consumed of one another. We've all known of churches that have sat and fought and fussed and carried on all kinds of contentions over one issue or another, many times personality clashes, to the point the church is ultimately destroyed, maybe in a community. I preached for a church for about 4 years some time ago. It was in a small community, about half the size of Payton City. And the church had destroyed its reputation in the community, where the members would go out and they would begin to not only bite and devour one another, literally in business meetings, you would have men standing up, shaking their finger and telling one another off. Sometimes at services, you'd see some sister having her tongue shaking it, or shaking her finger and wagging her tongue at some brother, telling him off. Visitors at gospel meetings sometimes would have to ask to go around the fuss to get out. And the church just sits there and destroys itself. And they go through the community telling the faults of other people. You sit and you bite and devour one another, and then finally they're consumed of one another. And its reputation is destroyed within a community. Go to the book of James, chapter 3, verse 8. We started on this verse a few moments ago. We're talking about the effect, the impact that the tongue can have. Its impact can be so great and so devastating and so dangerous. But James 3 and verse 8 says it's like giving someone poison. Notice in verse 8, for the tongue can no man tame, it is unruly, evil, full of deadly poison. Few of us, if any of us, would ever think about taking a glass full of poison and asking some of our brethren to drink that. Or give it to some of our family, would you drink some of this poison? And yet what I say about someone can be as devastating to them as giving them poison. What's poison going to do? It destroys them. I can do the same thing with my tongue. It has the same kind of impact, the same kind of effect. But let's go further. Let's notice also, while you're open to James chapter 3, back up two verses, it's like a fire. Notice in verse 6, the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is set on fire by our members and defiles the whole body, and then set on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire by hell. The tongue is like a spark. sets a wildfire that gets out of control. Many of the wildfires that we read about in the newspapers and we watch on televisions that burn in the West, where hundreds and hundreds or thousands of acres burned, started with maybe one cigarette someone threw out or a match someone threw down. One little spark. And yet that spark set off a whole blaze until maybe a whole forest, several houses, maybe whole cities are destroyed. And it's what he's saying about the tongue. The tongue is that can have that kind of impact, that it's like that little spark. If we saw some of the children playing up here after services and striking matches and throwing down onto the carpet, we'd say that's dangerous. Why? Well, that one little spark, that one little blaze could destroy this whole building, couldn't it? And yet we as adults may stand around and we're throwing little sparks of gossip. We're throwing little barbs toward one another and we're throwing those fires out that can destroy a whole family, a whole church, and someone's entire reputation. That's the impact and the effect that it can have. Now, here's the fourth and final point where we'll spend the rest of our time. Let's talk about how we can prevent that. I know the tongue's dangerous now. We've established that. And I know how it can be dangerous in the sense, here's what it can do. And now I see the impact and the effect that it can have. So what can I do to prevent that? What can I do in my own life to prevent that? Well, there are several things we want to list. Get your Bibles open, if you will, and let's turn to the book of Proverbs again. Go back to Proverbs. You might get a marker if you have one in your Bible and just mark somewhere in the middle of Proverbs, because we're going to be flipping back to Proverbs time and again. Let's start with the 10th chapter. The first thing that I want us to talk about is that we need to learn the principle of restraint. Just learning to restrain the tongue. Remember the bridle we talked about a moment ago? The purpose of the bridle is to hold the horse back and you restrain him so that you don't let him do everything he wants to do. We need to put some restraint on the tongue. Start with Proverbs 10 and verse 19. In the multitude of words, sin is not lacking. In other words, the more you say, the more apt you are to sin. The less you say, the less likelihood that you're going to say something wrong. But he who restrains his lips is wise. You want to be smart? Be a person of few words. Let's go to another passage. Let's go to the 15th chapter now of Proverbs and notice in verse 7. The lips of the wise disperse knowledge, but the heart of fools does not do so. The wise choose words carefully so that they're dispersing wisdom and knowledge. The fool doesn't care about that. Here's another passage. Let's go to the 16th chapter, verse 23. And notice the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds learning to his lips. I think he's taking the idea of the mouth or the tongue and personifying it as if you're setting it down, teaching it something. You're training it. Whether it's like training a dog or training some other animal or training your child. As you would set your child down and you try to teach it some things, now here's what you need to do, and I don't want to see this out of you anymore. It's like you set your tongue down and you're saying you're going to keep shut and you're not going to say some of the things you've said before. Notice again, let's read the passage again in that light, that the heart of the wise teaches his mouth. We need to give our mouth a lecture once in a while and tell it to keep shut. What he's telling us. Let's go to the 17th chapter now, one chapter over, verses 27 and 28. He who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of a calm spirit. A person who is real smart spares their words. Verse 28, even a fool is counted wise when he holds his peace. And when he shuts his lip, he is considered perceptive. Even a foolish person who doesn't seem to know anything will say he was wise to keep his mouth shut. And so would we be as well. You know what I learned from all of those passages? I learned a very basic principle that it's hard for us to understand and hard for us to apply, that you do not have to say all that you want to say. Isn't that a simple principle? I just learned from those passages, you don't have to say everything that you want to say. There are times I want to say some things that I just don't get around to saying. Why can't I say them? Because these passages tell me that you don't have to say everything that you want to say. Here's a second principle about how to prevent that. One, I need to learn restraint. Secondly, I need to learn to be careful about what I say to and about others. I need to learn to be careful what I say to and about others. Now, why is that true? That's true because what you may tell might be confidential. Have you ever been talking to someone and you're just rattling off and you give information and then suddenly you realize, I shouldn't have told that because that was told to me in confidence. I shouldn't have said that. That was something that somebody asked just to keep between us. May not be anything bad, but it was something someone said, now I want to tell you something and I want you to keep this in confidence because I'm just seeking advice from you. I need to be careful. You need to be careful. Because what you may be telling may be confidential. Here's another reason you need to be careful. And that is because what you say can be taken differently than what you intend. Has that ever happened to you? I'm sure it has. Where you intended in this spirit, but it's taken an entirely different spirit. Where it could have been interpreted this way or that way, and you thought surely they'll accept it this way, but they took it in a different way, and you have some explaining to do. Sometimes the misunderstanding may not be your fault, but make sure it's not your fault. Be careful what you say. And you be careful how you say. And you be careful what you say to and about others, because what you say may be taken differently than you intend. Let's go back to the book of Proverbs now. Let's go to the 11th chapter. Notice in Proverbs 11 and in verse 13, a talebearer reveals secrets, but he is of a faithful spirit concealed the matter. He's being careful. He's not telling everything he thinks. He's not telling everything he knows. Some things he conceals. Let's go to the 29th chapter of Proverbs, if you will, and notice in verse 11. Proverbs 29 and verse 11. Proverbs 29:11 says, a fool vents all his feelings, but a wise man holds them back. He's careful. But a fool's not careful. He says whatever's on his mind. Ever been around people, among Christians even, who whatever comes to their mind, whatever they think, however they feel, they have to say it. They won't let you know. If they don't like what you look like, if they don't like the clothes you have on, they're going to tell you. If they won't express their feeling about something, they just express their feeling about it. They say whatever's on their mind. They give no thought, have no wisdom, no judgment about what to say. A fool vents all his feelings. Text says, wise people don't do that. Here's another passage, James 1 and in verse 19. Let every man be swift to hear and slow to speak and slow to wrath. That is, do more listening than talking. That means I need to be careful. And do you realize that what you say may be repeated and quoted? I'm sometimes quoted by people that I'm thinking, I'm not sure I said that. Maybe I did, but I don't remember saying that. And would you want people running around saying, you know what, so-and-so said, and then they quote you. I need to be careful what I say because I just might be quoted on this. I just might be quoted on this. We would say that if we had a television camera in front of us and it was some big media event where they want a comment from you, you'd be very careful what you said because that's going to be aired all across the country. You know what? When we're sitting around talking to three or four people, we're careless in what we say, and those three people go out and they tell others, and then they tell others, and you're quoted just as much among the brethren. Be careful what you say. That's what I learned from these texts. Here's another principle. We need to be careful how we choose our words. We need to be careful how we choose our words. Make sure you convey what you want to convey. If you've ever been around people that are involved in religious discussion, formal religious debate, whether it be involved in some oral debate or whether it's a written exchange, I've had both. You have to weigh out carefully what you're going to say because you want to make sure, first of all, you are understood, and then secondly, I want to make sure I'm not misunderstood too. And you sometimes reword things and you weigh your words out carefully because I don't want to say the wrong thing. Well, the same thing is true in every conversation. I want to make sure that I convey what I want to convey, lest I be misunderstood. I need to weigh carefully and choose my words carefully. Now, how do I do that? Well, let's go to Proverbs 15 and verse 1. We ought to learn a very basic principle. If you don't learn anything else from this study tonight, if you learn this principle, your time will be well spent tonight, and that is to learn to use some tact. And that's not spelled with a K. The passage says, a soft answer turns away wrath, and a harsh word stirs up anger. Watch what you say and watch how you say it. You know, you can tell somebody they're on the road to destruction and they're on the road to hell, and you can do it in a tactful manner so that they glean from your words that you care about them and they understand that you are concerned for their soul. Or you can say it in such a way that it's harsh and it's unloving and uncaring, as if you don't think a thing about this person. And both said the same thing. Where I've worked with local churches, we've had people who would quit coming to church, and someone would go see them and just turn them off. And all they're trying to tell them is, we miss you at church and wish you'd come back and we think your soul is in danger. And someone else goes say the same basic thing and they're encouraged. What's the difference? Somehow it's how they approach that. Read again the proverb with me, if you will. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Use some tact. Here's something else. Or in the 15th chapter, let's learn this principle. Think before you speak. Proverbs 15:28. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer. I don't think he's talking about that the righteous goes over here and he studies from the Word of God so that he can prepare a lesson, so that he can give answer for the reason of the hope that is within him. That's true. I think he's talking about he thinks about what he says before he says it. That's what the passage is talking about. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the foolish pours forth evil. The person who doesn't care, a person who's foolish, just says whatever comes to their mind. But the righteous person now, he weighs his words out carefully. He's going to use some tact, and he's going to think before he speaks. Go to the 12th chapter of Proverbs. Back up a little bit, if you will. The 12th chapter in verse 18. There is one who speaks like the piercing of a sword. The tongue of the wise will tell. There are some people can say something, it's like jabbing with a sword. When they do that, it hurts. And then there's others who speak words that promote health. What's the difference? It's how they chose their words. It's how they chose their words. Here's another principle. Watch your timing. Watch your timing. Proverbs 15:23 says a man has joy by the answer of his mouth and a word spoken in due season. How good. The right timing. It might be that I encouraged someone, but I might have been just a little too late on that. It would have been a whole lot better if that had been a week or two before. Watch your timing. Or it might have been a rebuke would have been good, but maybe this is not the time or the place for it. Remember Job's friends? One of Job's friends told him, after his children were destroyed and gone, that perhaps God will bless you and give you more children. Not a bad point. Timing was kind of bad. It's like going to the funeral home while someone is there weeping over their child that's dead, and you say something to him, maybe God will bless you with more children. Kind of a tactless thing to say at that point. Maybe things will be better and you'll have more children and you forget about this. What's your timing about what you say? Here's another principle. Let's go again to Proverbs, the 18th chapter, if you will. Let's be careful about what we repeat. All of us, if I were to ask for a show of hands, all of us have heard something from someone else and we've told someone else, then haven't we? Sometimes it's good news, sometimes it's bad news. All of us have repeated things. That within itself is not wrong. Well, let's notice some passages that may warn us about that. Let's understand this principle, Proverbs 18 and verse 17, that there are two sides to the story, perhaps. Verse 17 says, the first one to plead his cause seems right. Until his neighbor comes and examines him. Maybe two people are at odds and there's friction between these two brothers, and one of them comes to you, or two sisters, as the case may be. One of them comes to you and they tell their side of the story, and when you listen to that side of the story, whose side sounds right? The one you just heard. And it may be that there's another side to that you need to consider. And in most cases where there's been friction and one side comes to me, when I finally hear the other side, I find that there's another side to the story somewhere. Someone's not telling the whole side. Not because they're being dishonest, they have two different perspectives of what the problem was. So before I get some piece of information and I run off and I begin to spread that, I need to understand, you know what, there may be another side to the story to this. Proverbs 18:17 says so. Now, here's another principle along the same line. While we're in the same chapter, back up to verse 13, don't jump to conclusions. Notice verse 13, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame. What does it mean, answers a matter before he hears it? That is, you have an answer, you have a response, you have something to say about it before you gather all the data and all the evidence in. I've already condemned Brother so-and-so and told others that he's wrong before I got all the evidence in. There may be more involved in this. So I need to be careful what I repeat. Because it just very well may be there's another side of the story. Or I may have answered a matter before I had all the evidence. I don't know if you're like me. There's been things I've told that I wished I'd have waited till I heard the other side. There have been things I've repeated that I wished I'd waited and gotten more evidence before I had repeated that. Haven't you? One last principle and the lesson will be yours. Let's talk about the principle of giving the benefit of the doubt. We need to learn to give the benefit of the doubt. Let's turn in our Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and in verse 7. Giving the characteristics of love and the qualities of agape, that is love, the highest form of love, one of the things he mentions in 1 Corinthians 13 and in verse 7 is that love believes all things. That does not suggest that love is gullible. But what he's suggesting is that love gives the benefit of the doubt in some of the translations, which may not be the most reliable, I understand. But one of the translations, I forgot if it's Moffat, I believe it is Moffat, or perhaps Williams, that translates it, that love gives the benefit of the doubt. Here's a couple of comments. First from Barnes, here's what he says about this verse, about love believes all things. He said it must mean that in regard to the conduct of others, there is a disposition to put the best construction on it, to believe that it must be actuated by good motives, and that they intend no injury, and that there is a willingness to suppose, as far as can be, that what was done is done consistently with friendship, good feeling, and virtue. I say amen to that. What Barnes is saying is, what the passage is saying is that we ought to put the best construction on what someone said or did and give the benefit of the doubt. We've all been in circumstances where someone said something or did something and it could be taken in a bad light or it could be taken in a good light, and give them the benefit of the doubt, but the best construction. If you make an error, err on the side of giving them the benefit of the doubt rather than jumping to the wrong conclusion. Here's what Clark said. Clark said that love is ever ready to believe the best. That's the idea of believing all things. He's ever ready to believe the best in every person and will credit no evil of any but on the most positive evidence. I may think Brother so-and-so meant me wrong when he said so, said something about me. But I only need to conclude that on the most positive of evidence and not my jumping to the conclusion. Love needs to give the benefit of the doubt. Let's turn to Proverbs, the 14th chapter, if you will. Notice a few more passages along that very point. Proverbs 14 and in verse 15. The simple believe every word. They're gullible. But the prudent man considers well his steps. And that is, I need to give it the benefit of the doubt. I need to, raise questions like, do I have the evidence? Do I have evidence of the charge I'm making? I make accusations of others. Do I know what I'm talking about? Is it possible that there is another explanation? Is it possible that there is another explanation than the one that I'm trying to give? Go to Proverbs 18 and verse 13. We've read this already, but this certainly applies here in giving the benefit of the doubt. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame. When I get part of the evidence and jump to the conclusion. Would you appreciate it if you were on trial when the jurors heard about a third of the evidence that they went off to the back room and started deliberating while other evidence is being given in the courtroom? How would you like that? You say, they convicted me, but they didn't have all the evidence. They ignored about half of it, or about two-thirds of it. They only had part of it, and they ran off in the room, and they made their decision. How unfair. And yet we do that with one another. We get a little bit of information. We don't have all the data. And we jump to our conclusions. And Proverbs 29 and verse 20 warns us about hasty words. Give the benefit of the doubt. What have we seen in our study tonight? We talk about being stewards of the tongue. Being stewards of the tongue. Just as we are stewards of our material possession, God expects us to be stewards of our tongue. The tongue is dangerous. It's very dangerous. We see what it can do. We see the effect that it can have. And we see how to prevent that. And what that means is that every one of us can work harder at being more careful about what we say, how we say it, and to whom we say it. Could you work harder at that? When I go through studies like this, it reminds me that no matter how much I preach on it, how much I teach on it, how much I can cite the passages, I still need to keep working and keep working and keep working and being careful what I say and how I say it and to whom I may say it.